This is Young Lawyer Rising from the ABA Young Lawyers Division and Legal Talk Network. Listeners, welcome back. I'm your host, Montana Funk. Today, I am joined by David Mandelbaum. David is a shareholder in the environmental practice of Greenberg and Traurig. David started practicing environmental law in 1984 and has over 30 years as practice group head. David is also currently a fellow of the American College of Environmental Lawyers and was educated at Harvard College. Today, David and I sit down and discuss the different types of environmental law practice and the different issues facing the environmental law sector today. Good afternoon, David. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good afternoon. Happy to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. You know, today is a new area that I haven't spoken about much on this podcast, if really at all, and that's the area of environmental law and all things kind of surrounding that. And, you know, something I want to start off with is obviously you've been practicing since 1984, so you have a lot of years of experience in this area. And something I'm kind of just curious about to kick off the episode is how you've seen environmental law change throughout your practice.
Well, there are a couple of changes that are going to keep happening, and then some changes that are probably once and done. The changes that are going to keep happening are that this is a subject matter field, right? It's not a functions field. So a litigator is expert in the mechanics of litigation, and what the cases are just what happens to walk in the door. In an area like environmental law or tax or benefits or those kinds of subject matter disciplines, the subject matter, the substance, really drives what people are doing, not so much the particular service. So those subject matters change and cycle with different priorities. Each new federal or state administration has different things they're working on. Different problems pop up, other problems get resolved. So, you know, today, climate is a very big issue. We were talking about climate in the 90s, but there was no work. Now there is. Solid waste facilities were a very big issue in the 90s, and right now that issue is pretty well understood and routinized. So that kind of subject matter cycling is one kind of continuing change, and it's always changing. And given the young lawyer audience for this podcast, that's an important feature for people. The other thing that is probably a secular once and done change is I got in kind of a half generation after the first movers, so that the people who were the senior lawyers at the time that I was a brand new lawyer were, you know, in their 40s or 50s, young 50s. And that's a lot. That was a lot of compression. And it's not going to be true now or ever again, because we've cycled through the full lifespan of environmental lawyers, so that we have oldsters like me and youngsters, and we have the full range in seniority now.
So do you think, and kind of an opposite of that question, do you think that there's main fundamental principles in the area of environmental law that will always remain? And if so, what are those?
That's an interesting question. I think that the principles in environmental law that will always remain are sort of the principles that are in law that always remain, right? Our job is to figure out how to get better outcomes for our clients. And we're doing it against the backdrop of particular legislative programs and regulatory agencies. And that's true for lots of different kinds of lawyers, but how you maneuver in that kind of world is sort of a set of skills that we've all learned how to do, and we will continue to learn how to do.
So do you think for the young lawyers listening and who are interested in, you know, environmental law, but are unsure kind of where to go, something that I wonder is, you'd mentioned the litigation aspect, and then you also mentioned, you know, regulatory agencies' role in this area. So for someone who might be interested in this area of practice, do you find that it's more driven by, you know, policies and regulations and drafting documents? Or, you know, what are those opportunities for maybe the litigants who are listening and want to kind of dabble in this area?
Well, for litigators, right, there are several different kinds of litigation. And if I had to characterize myself, I'd call myself a litigator. I mean, I've certainly done all kinds of, you know, offered all kinds of services, but most people would identify me as a litigator. So there are different kinds of litigation that get called environmental. And I'm just going to tick off a few. Mm-hmm. The core, the center of the bullseye, the thing that's in the case books, and the thing that the original environmental lawyers think of is litigation with agencies over administrative decisions. And so an agency does something that your client doesn't like. It adopts a rule, or more, for more people, right, who are not dealing with big policy issues on behalf of an industry group or something, but instead are dealing with particular problems of particular clients at particular sites. A permit gets issued or denied or issued on with certain conditions in it. And the permittee or the applicant is unhappy, or alternatively, the neighbors are unhappy or the municipality is unhappy. Mm-hmm. There are avenues to get judicial review of those decisions. And those avenues are different in different jurisdictions. If you're thinking about federal permits, you know, it's the Administrative Procedure Act litigation that you learned about in law school. It's either a petition for review to a court of appeals or a declaratory judgment action in some federal district court. Most of the permit decisions that get made, though, in the United States are made by state environmental regulators, because most of the federal environmental programs have available the option of delegation to state agencies. So those are really dependent on state procedures. You know, there are some states have an administrative tribunal that hears things. Pennsylvania's is one. You go to a thing called the Environmental Hearing Board. Other places, you file an action in a trial court as the first step. And like New York is like that, Massachusetts is like that. And that's one flavor of litigation. There's been a lot of time taken up over the past 30 years, and a lot of my time taken up in litigating under the federal cleanup programs and state cleanup programs. There's some litigation over litigation with the government over who is liable and what they're liable for. But in general, those are, I don't know what the technical term for it is, losers. So much of the time is spent allocating responsibility among responsible parties, which, I mean, it may be just a quirk of my experience that I actually am one of the people who's known is knowing how to do that. But if you imagine if you have a several dozen or hundred parties responsible for the same set of costs jointly and severally, and no clear guidance, and there is no clear guidance. I mean, the guidance in the federal Superfund statute, for example, is that that allocation among them should be using such equitable factors as the court determines are appropriate, meaning like due fairness, right? So what mm-hmm. does that mean, you know? And you're going through years and years or decades and decades of what I call the who shot John, like, you know, how many pounds of what was in your waste? How many pounds of what was in your wastewater discharge? Or how many years did you do this activity or that activity? There are a zillion microfacts and no one true way to allocate among the parties. So that can be a very time-consuming and difficult piece of litigation. Many people think of things like tort kinds of claims, including public nuisance sorts of claims that are often brought by governmental or NGO entities. The example that would pop into your head right now would be litigation over climate change. You know, against the government or against their cases pending against large oil companies alleging contributions to greenhouse gas emissions and seeking some sort of relief.
So I want to take a quick break, but I do want to get more into the role of, you know, mentors who've been in this area for quite a long time versus those that are just coming into it. So let's take a quick break and then let's bounce back into that. It can be frustrating to wade through the malpractice insurance application process, but you know you need to protect your firm. Alps designed their application to be flexible, easy, and 100% online. Fill it out, review your quote, accept, and pay in as little as 10 minutes. Alps is the nation's largest direct writer of lawyers' malpractice insurance, and they are endorsed by more bar associations than any other carrier, so they understand law firms. They also know how valuable your time is, and that's why they make legal malpractice insurance easy. Visit alpsinsurance.com to learn more. That's alpsinsurance.com.
Filing court documents, serving legal papers, collecting electronic signatures, all critical parts of the litigation process, yet ones that are time-consuming and error-prone. But what if you could do more straight from your case or document management software? InfoTrack automates data entry, document selection, tracking, and information syncing across all these core tasks and more by integrating with your core systems like Clio, Smokeball, Leap, MyCase, and others. Spend more time on substantive legal work and less time on busy work. Learn how simple it can be at infotrack.com/simple.
So before the break, we were talking about the areas for those who want to go into litigation, and we were talking about torts and, you know, also mentioning the different roles and jobs that people have and having to delegate. Something that, you know, is I'm questioning, and obviously in an area of law like environmental law, which to me at least, you know, appears more difficult, a little bit more nuanced. How do you find, or what have you seen works to balance, you know, the jobs being delegated to either the mentors who are, you know, partners or shareholders who have been practicing for years versus young lawyers who come in and, you know, don't have that experience? Do you find that there is a disconnect between giving those younger lawyers opportunities just because of that lack of experience?
No. I mean, there's some things that young lawyers just aren't as good as old lawyers at, but I don't think that that's necessarily subject matter connected. In fact, the nature of our subject matter makes opportunities for young lawyers. So remember at the beginning, I said there's regular change in what's top of mind for the government or what where enforcement is going or what issues are hot. Well, when you get a new regulation, when you get a new policy initiative, when there's a new slate of cases, it's new. And I'm no further up the learning curve on the details of that than somebody who's, you know, graduated from law school last week. So if you are in a position to learn something, you can be the subject matter expert ahead of it, everybody, including the senior people. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that your ability to exercise judgment is as well honed as a senior person's would be, but you actually know what the regulation says, or you know what those last three cases said. So I think that's in some ways, a valuable use of junior lawyers, which is somebody's got to, you know. Let's take something from the news recently. You may have read that the SEC issued a regulation calling for standardization, if you will, of reporting about greenhouse gas emissions and steps that registrants take to protect against climate risks. Okay. That was almost 800 pages in TypeScript.
Oof.
And while it sounds really environmental and has a lot of environmental components to it. You also have to understand things like Regulation SK. And I will confess to you that I'm not even sure they had a Regulation SK when I went to law school. You know, everything was on clay tablets. But I didn't take securities regulation, so this is new news for me.
Yeah. Right?
So there you go. That's a lot of time and a lot of words to sound out that might as well be done by somebody junior.
Absolutely. And I understand that, right? Because it's kind of nice to hear from your perspective that this area, there are so many things that are coming up every day that are new, and having someone who's, you know, new to the legal world or a junior associate being able to delve into that and offer this new perspective. And like you had said earlier, there's things that you're just learning too with subject matter. It is nice to know and kind of encouraging, I hope, for our listeners to hear, you know, yeah, you're not going to have the expertise and, you know, maybe how you deal with clients or some of that stuff, the knowledge that you'd have from years of practice, but they can still come in and offer a fresh new perspective. And the subject matter might be the same for them that it would be for someone who's been practicing for 30 years.
That's right. The real question is, how does somebody who's younger acquire the ability to do more than just read a legal authority and report on it? You know, nobody went to law school to do book reports.
Absolutely. And do you find, you know, I guess I should ask it a different way, but what is advice that you would provide to new young lawyers that, you know, want to succeed, want to not only, like you said, just sit and read and highlight and research, et cetera, but developing client relationships and developing actual litigation skills? What are the tips that you would give those young lawyers to say, hey, you can actually expand beyond just these initial, you know, like you said, document review? So how can they actually become successful lawyers in all areas and develop that knowledge and skill?
All right. That's a big question.
It is.
It's a big question. And I don't think that the answer is specific to environmental practice or any other practice area. The first thing that you have to have is you have to make the switch in your own head from thinking about what you do as what school was like, which is, you know, there's material that you're given. There's a question you're asked at the end of the semester. The professor knows the answer to the question, and they're just testing how close you can get to the answer to the question.
Yeah.
That's not what practice is like, right? Practice, as you know, is developing your own career, right? And nobody is worrying about your career the way the professor was worrying about teaching you things. When I worry about somebody's career in the morning when I'm in the shower, it's not my associate's career. It's mine, right? So it's your career. You've got to take control of it. And there's a lot of conversation that people have about what they would like to do. And I think who they would like to represent, what engagement they would like. I tend to think that's kind of the wrong question, or it's an incomplete question. Mm-hmm. Because the important question is, for what are you the right choice? What task, what legal assignment, in what area, for what kind of client, are you the right choice? And because if you're the wrong choice, you're never going to get another one, right? Or it's much harder to get another one. And you want to figure out for whom you're the right choice and get in front of those people somehow. And when I say right choice, that doesn't mean you're the best person on the planet in that area. You know, you don't have to be the best litigator on the planet. You just have to be the best mix of knowledge, affect, price, attention. You know, the more junior you are, the more you pay attention to things which senior people will regard as routine, and therefore clients who have more routine problems or are smaller clients may prefer a more junior lawyer because, you know, it's hard to be the lawyer's biggest client if you're just not that big a client unless the lawyer isn't that big a lawyer, right?
Absolutely.
So figure out how to make yourself the right choice for some list of or some set of matters and or matter client pairs, right? And figure out what those are. Now, if you've been out of law school 2 years, you're going to hate that list, right? It's going to be a thin list, and it's not going to be exactly where you want to be when you grow up. So then you got to think about how to get better at that, you know, how to get a better list, learn more things. The other difficult thing to do, I think, is learning how to accredit yourself. You know, if your job, the analogy I use is canned soup, and I apologize for any of your listeners who've, who've heard this before, but if your job was making canned soup, the first thing you'd have to do is figure out how to make good soup.
Yeah.
And that's learning some law, right? And learning how to do some things. But then if you put it in a steel can, you know what a steel can looks like. You can't tell what's in there. It could be peas. It could be soup, right? So you got to figure out how to put a label on the can. And unlike Campbell's, you can't put good on the cover of the can. That's not the way lawyers market themselves, right? You have to figure out ways to say, I know stuff, without actually saying the words, I know stuff, right? The message is different from the words you say. That's why lawyers are always doing writing and speaking and appearing on podcasts and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And you need to be driving those activities towards accrediting yourself on matters which you would like to be engaged on and where you would be the right choice because of, you know, your mix of expertise, attention, price, and on and on.
I really like that soup analogy. I have actually not heard that before, but, you know, it makes sense that kind of having your set of, you know, areas that you want to either practice in or that interest you or that you have expertise in, really, because that really can build a base for, you know, the area that you want to continue to grow in. And I think that it's, you're right that you obviously can't just put, I'm the best at this, and that's how you market yourself, but kind of building that base and having that list is something that I've never thought of in that kind of way. So I think that our listeners can really hopefully grasp onto that. And that's, you know, a new perspective we haven't had. So I appreciate that perspective. You know, and I want to make sure something that we can talk about in this episode before we wrap things up is the regulatory process as well. So we've talked a little bit about litigation. I want to take a quick break, but when we come back, I kind of want to jump into regulations and that area. This episode is brought to you by the American Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. Starting a new career in the law can feel overwhelming. The ABA YLD provides resources, CLE, and a network of peers from coast to coast to help you settle into your new legal career. Claim your Young Lawyer membership for just $75 at ambar.org/join.
Delegate out those tasks that take up your time. Staffy can help you with your legal, administrative, marketing, and even client-facing workload. Hiring Staffy's top-notch bilingual virtual staff means Staffy does the recruiting, hiring, and training for you. Then, if you need a change, Staffy handles it. You get to concentrate on your strategic work. Schedule a free consultation at staffy.cc. That's STAFI.cc and get $500 off with code HAPPY24.
So we've talked a lot about litigation, building your practice, how you can become, you know, a good attorney, not just in the area of environmental law, but in every area. And something that I want to make sure that we do touch on, because it is a pretty important and big aspect of this area, is regulations. So, you know, something that I'm curious about, and I'm sure our listeners are too, is what challenges do you think are out there when it comes to the environmental regulatory process?
The environmental regulatory process is long in every jurisdiction, right? You know, even in small states, it takes a long time to go from let's go write a regulation to having a regulation. Right now, there is a substantial portion of the political spectrum that's not hostile to regulation on the ground that the policy or the particular regulation is a bad idea, but instead there's active hostility to the whole notion of having regulatory agencies exert much control at all. So, you know, clearly you wouldn't be in my line of work if you didn't think that the administrative state was a good idea for at least something. Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of people who don't think that. And so every time the government tries to do something, or you would like the government to do something, there's at least right now a chorus of voices that says, no, no, you unelected bureaucrats should not be in control of that. Now, honestly, I don't know how you solve most environmental problems unless you have unelected bureaucrats regulating, right? How do you get a whole lot of discharges to a stream? How do you assure that the water quality in that stream is adequate unless you've got somebody who isn't the dischargers figuring out how much each one can put into the stream, right? And if we're slowly poaching the planet, or rapidly poaching the planet, how do you allocate the ability to emit greenhouse gases among parties when it's really, you know, it's not really a market there for that? You've got to create a market, or you've got to create regulation or something, right? And that's not just going to happen organically. So then once you figure out you want to do it, you've got to figure out how to make or help the government do it. Or if you're in the government, do it yourself. And that can be challenging.
Do you think there's a way for lawyers in your area to make that process more efficient and effective?
Sure, but to the extent that it's adversarial, there's always somebody who wants to make it less efficient and effective, right?
Yeah.
And if they're good at it, they will make it less efficient and effective. Government lawyers have a big role in this, right? Mm-hmm. The better they run their rulemaking process, and the better they draft, then the better the outcome and the quicker it appears. But for the rest of us on the outside, all we can do is suggest or advocate.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And do you find that you work a lot with government workers, or do you find that you feel like the attorneys are kind of on the outside looking in when it comes to that kind of stuff and policymaking and, you know, reform, et cetera?
Well, you know, the thing about my particular practice is, you know, that is the environmental practice, is it's kind of a relatively small club. I would bet there are maybe 15,000 environmental lawyers in the whole United States.
Wow.
So it's a little bit of a secret handshake society. And to some extent, less so than when I was a young lawyer, but still to some extent, the private practitioners, the NGO practitioners, and the government practitioners all think that they're part of the same club. They just have different clients. So we just last week had the Pennsylvania Environmental Law Forum, which is the, you know, 2-day CLE confab of Pennsylvania environmental lawyers. We get about 300 people each of the 2 days. I'm one of the planners. And we're very heavily populated with government lawyers, with a bunch of NGOs too. And, you know, we're chatting each other up about each of the things we're working on. So, yeah, people work all the time with each other because they know each other and they tend to be reasonably friendly. The idea that there are sides, I guess, is more prevalent among some. But if you get too doctrinaire about it, you disable yourself.
Yeah. I can imagine, too, that, I mean, obviously, like you said, you get to know people, even if they're in different areas, and you guys talk to one another about what's going on. And I can imagine that that also helps practice in the long run as well. And, you know, like we're talking about making things more efficient and effective, having those relationships and strong relationships probably does make it, I mean, at least from my perspective, and, you know, let me know if I'm wrong, but probably does help when it comes to that kind of stuff because of just those relationships, you know, outside of the actual work you're doing every day.
Yeah, life is long and the world is small. You're going to bump into all these people again. I mean, you're a defender, correct?
I am, yes.
So you would not imagine trying to get through your week without having a relationship with the prosecutors.
Exactly.
Or with the judges. I mean, that's just what you do. And the same for them.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I mean, I always say having good relationships with, you know, my judge and the prosecutors I work with always makes my life and my client's life easier because things just get resolved better when you can maintain, you know, good, strong relationships, and it doesn't need to be always animosity between the two sides. So I do appreciate, you know, saying that it doesn't have to be two sides and, you know, two groups. It actually does make things better in the long run to have that good working relationship.
For everybody.
Exactly. So I want to ask you two more questions. I'm going to make them easy, but at least I think they're easy. But I guess the first one I want is, you know, we've talked about a lot over this episode. And one thing I think is important for our listeners to have is people who've listened in and are saying, yep, I want to do this area. This seems interesting to me. What resources are there nationally that you know about that those young lawyers wanting to dip their toes in can reach out to get some information or maybe just see if it actually is what they want to do?
All right. The ABA has a section on environment, energy, and resources, SEER. I believe that it has a mentorship program as well. So you may be able to sign up as a mentee, but in a minimum, check out the website. There are regular publications, regular meetings, which may be a little pricey, but there are a whole set of resources you can get essentially for free off of that. Most state bars have an environmental or a natural resources section, depending on where you are in the country, because those two tend to be fairly closely allied. They often have similar kinds of publications and mentorships. Also in the large cities, there are, you know, the Metropolitan Bar Association will have that kind of thing. Law schools who have or which have an environmental professor, that professor will kind of know or should know the local bar. I mean, that may be, that may vary. I mean, I know at the law school in Philadelphia where I am an adjunct, people will sometimes point to me rather than to the regular professor. The regular professor is much more connected to the NGO bar than to the private sector bar. Mm-hmm. So people may end up with me. But remember, there's this fear among law students, I really just want a job, because people have, you know, like they made a mistake. They went to law school and therefore they have loans and they need a job, right? And they think, I don't want to specialize, because if I specialize, there are only a couple of jobs and I might not get it. Well, that's true, but there are only a couple of people looking for the jobs. So what you need to do is just to get into that circle. It's a relatively small circle, even in places like where I practice, where there are relatively large numbers of environmental lawyers. It's a group you can name, right? Maybe Philadelphia has maybe 250 environmental lawyers, right? So just get into the circle. Say ask people to have a cup of coffee with you, and they may have heard so-and-so is looking. And that's how you get in.
Yeah, that is, you know, really good advice. It's like you said earlier, the secret handshake thing. I mean, just going into an area that seems, you know, probably a lot of people coming out of law school, I can say that I was one of them. It's daunting to, you know, knowing that you need to build a career and build these relationships. But, you know, like you said, ask someone for coffee, just get to know people, create those relationships outside of work first, and a lot of things fall into place. So I hope that our listeners, you know, who maybe are having some reservations or who are nervous, can take away that, you know, there's going to be lots of opportunities. You just kind of have to put your foot in the door and put yourself out there. And I think people will be more successful than they maybe give themselves credit for.
I will say this, Montana. You know, I'm at this point the big, scary older guy, right? People ask me for career advice, you know, and they tend to be, you know, some attenuated relationship, you know, like my aunt's sister's cousin's friend knows your wife, right?
Yeah.
But I can't remember ever saying, no, I won't chat with you. And I can't remember anybody else I know ever saying, no, I won't chat with a law student or a young lawyer. It doesn't mean I'm going to offer you a job. It just means I'll give you whatever wisdom I have, and I'll give you all the market gossip I have.
Which is sometimes, honestly, really helpful. And I hope that people take advantage of that and talking to people like you who are willing to, because even if there's not a job on the other end of it, I think it's just invaluable being able to talk to someone who has wisdom and practice and, you know, can offer that perspective of being in the area for so many years. So I appreciate that you're willing to do that. And I do hope that our listeners take that advice and go out there and put themselves out there and just start the conversation. One last question for you. Easiest one is, where can our listeners find you specifically?
They can find me hiding under my desk as usual. If you go to the Greenberg Traurig website, gtlaw.com, and just put in my name, Mandelbaum, just remember it's E-L, not L-E, I will pop up and it has all my contact information.
Perfect. Well, that is all I have for you. I hope that last one was as easy as I said, but I appreciate you coming on today. And I'm really excited about this episode. I hope that some of our listeners, like I said, who are wanting to, you know, dip their toes in this area, or even just listeners who need that advice about how to grow as an attorney and how to put their feet in the water of any area, I hope that they got some good takeaways. So thank you so much for joining me today, David.
Thank you for having me. Good to talk to you.
Listeners, that is our show. I want to thank you, as always, for tuning in, and you know where to find us. If you like us, please recommend our show to a friend. Thank you for joining, and I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Until next time, I'm your host, Montana Funk, and you've been listening to Young Lawyer Rising, brought to you by the ABA Young Lawyers Division and the audio professionals at the Legal Talk Network.
The Lunch Hour Legal Marketing Podcast, your resource for the tips and tactical advice you need to grow your business. Plus, keep up with the news and commentary you crave to stay one step ahead. It's hosted by me, Guy Sakalakis.
And me, Conrad Song. Every other week, we break down the issues holding back your marketing strategy and talk about the changes you need to be prepared for. Check out the Lunch Hour Legal Marketing Podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.